Hi, everybody. Welcome to the next episode of Engineer Your Career. On the show today, we move a little bit closer to the business side of engineering as we talk to Kevin Wittrup. Kevin is a proud graduate of Michigan Technological University, where he received an MS in Mechanical Engineering in 1995. He spent the first 12 years of his career in product development at General Motors in a progression of engineering and management roles, during which time he also received an MBA from the Ross School of Business at the University of Michigan. Motivated by long-term personal goals and his business school experience, Kevin left General Motors in 2007 to join up with an experienced entrepreneur who was forming an early-stage entrepreneurial management and investment firm. Since that time, Kevin has operated as founder, investment manager, and our key operator in six startup companies involving highly engineered products in the mobility, healthcare, and energy sectors that have collectively raised over $60 million in investment capital. This is not an episode you'll want to miss. Kevin, welcome to EYC.
Welcome, everyone, to another episode of the Engineer Your Career podcast. I'm Brennan Timorek, and as always, I'm joined with the great Troy Bauman. Troy, how you doing?
Welcome, everyone. Dude, I'm doing great. Another great day living in the Upper Peninsula, man. I feel like we got like 3 feet of snow on the ground. We're finally having more of winter. We didn't get hardly any snow in January, but we got a ton now, so loving it. I got to go sledding. I don't know. Man. The best part about having snow for winter is you can actually do stuff.
You are so lucky. We have like 2 melted inches on the ground. But you know what? We'll get through. We'll get through down here. So Troy, you up to anything cool lately? PhD stuff, kid stuff, family stuff?
Yeah, well, I mean, we just got a dog, so that adds a whole lot to life. So that's been busy. But in terms of work and stuff, PhD stuff's been good. Just trying to get data collected. It's so hard in the PhD life just because everything's really ambiguous. But you know, trying to work through it, trying to learn some stuff. I think you told me that you're doing some new learning. What's new?
Yeah, I've really decided maybe like the past 3 weeks that I want to find more time in my day to learn some new like skills, technical areas that I'm interested in. So I've found that time by instead of like snoozing my alarm for like 15, 20 minutes in the morning, I just get out of bed now right at like 5:55 and spend 20 minutes, the first 20 minutes of my day, kind of reading some books and working on some projects to kind of like have that more time in my day. So I'm pretty excited about it because it's stuff that I've wanted to learn and really interested in. So trying to carve out that time in my day.
Dude, that's so tough, man. That's like, I think there's a lot of people that think that like, I'm going to do this, but then they try it the first day and it just like fails miserably. How did you get past that? Like, did you do anything different? Did you have to change up the first day or like what did you do?
So I'm notoriously bad at getting up when my alarm goes off. My wife, will make fun of me all the time. So
as is most people.
True. I think I had two things. I had read two books recently, which I'd highly recommend. One is called Ultra Learning and the other one is called Atomic Habits. And they're both kind of based around this idea of like how to kind of structure a learning project and then how to go about, I don't know, how can you have good habits in your life? And so one of those things I wanted to do was I wanted to get up earlier and like do something productive in my mornings when I can. So it was kind of like, all right, I've read about this. I think I can do it. Here's 15 minutes of my day that was really not good sleep anyway, just hitting snooze every 5-10 minutes. So one day I decided, all right, I'm just going to get up and do it. And for the most part, I've been able to do it for the past 3 weeks or so, except when I got sick. But you know what? I'm okay with that.
Dude, that's awesome, man. That's really fantastic.
Yeah, we'll see how long it goes. No promises in the future once I have kids if that's going to happen, as I'm sure you can understand. But for right now, I'm going to go with it. So we'll see.
Yeah, yeah. Life has a way of keeping you plenty busy. But on the show today, we have a guy who has no shortage of busyness in his life. Kevin Wittrup is on the line. Kevin, how you doing?
Excellent. Thank you.
Good. Really, really glad that you're here. Really excited to hear about your story. And maybe we should just start with your origin story. Let's tell us a little bit about how you got to where you are today and a little bit of an intro to you.
Yeah, absolutely. Be happy to do so. Actually, I'll fill in a little bit of additional topic, additional content here that I think would be relevant to your topic, because this is something when I meet people, I have to, you know, to introduce myself and condense this into a, you know, a really short blurb. So I'm going to give you a little bit more. I'm a mid-90s graduate of Michigan Tech and spent 6 years up there going through graduate school. Got a master's degree in mechanical engineering, concentrating primarily in the mechanical system dynamics area, so structural dynamics, a lot of signal processing and system modeling. And I went to work at General Motors after that at the proving grounds and had the opportunity for the first 5 or 6 years of my career to do a lot of fairly technical and heavily analytical and somewhat creative research type work, which was a little bit unusual, but it was relevant in the longer story here because I was able to continue to develop some technical skills that have been relevant in my business applications, which we'll talk about here in a few minutes. And in the process of that, I was lucky enough to be identified as one of the high potential young engineers that General Motors wanted to develop through the managerial ranks. And as such, started moving, as is typical for those programs, from job to job every couple of years or so to get a breadth of experience throughout the company, and also had the opportunity during that time to go to business school. And so to go get my MBA at Ross down at Michigan, University of Michigan, Ross. And that was a great experience for me and something that I certainly aspired to do. And also had, when I entered into business school, I did it with an eye of not necessarily staying in product development engineering or even with General Motors, perhaps for the duration of my career. I was looking to make a career pivot at that point. Although obviously my position at General Motors was pretty comfortable and also pretty exciting. So I had no particular sense of urgency, but it was something that I always wanted to explore. And as I went into business school, I did it with an eye of getting into analytical finance. So taking my engineering training, which again was heavily analytical and system modeling based, and applying it to analytical finance on Wall Street or the Chicago Board of Options or something along those lines. And this would have been early 2000s before quantitative trading had, is what it is today. So there was, certainly an area that was high growth at that particular time. And during my course of business school, I learned that that was not really what I wanted to do. I had a young family, didn't want to have to move to a financial center. And there were some other issues that I had with that, just in terms of the value it creates. So I pivoted my focus a little bit more towards the entrepreneurial finance side of things. So now you're talking venture capital, investment banking, those types of things. And that's where I focused during my time at business school. And as I got towards the end of my business school, I got out of business school back at General Motors doing the, the rotational management development things. And stayed with that for a while because, again, it was exciting and General Motors was a great place to work and they treated me very well. But I got to a point where, and I'm going to say I can tell you exactly the day I was sitting on Memorial Day on my porch, the evening of Memorial Day in 2006, and watching the sunset and thought, I don't want to go to work tomorrow because I know what the next 30 years of my career are going to look like. And I don't want to look in that mirror and see the global automotive executive that had moved to 4 different countries and take his family and do all those things. I just didn't want that for me. And I think that's great for some people, but it wasn't for me. And that was, to me, the start of my transition into a new career path. So it took me about 6 or 8 months of working my business school networks to find an opportunity to that was suitable for me to leave because I wasn't in a position where I could just obviously quit a job and figure out what to do next kind of thing. And that's what I did. So I found I teamed up with a local entrepreneur out of the Ann Arbor area who was attempting to start a entrepreneurial management firm and raise a early stage venture capital fund. And I joined up with him. It was a team of two at that point, and we set about that task. Now, he was obviously considerably more experienced in the area, had a little bit of a track record and a network that supported that type of activity. And so we set out on that path of raising money and trying to find places to place investments and also engage in the entrepreneurial management of the entity. So the model was sort of, it wasn't a straight venture capital model insofar as we had about a $2 million fund that we had a $2 million war chest that we were able to raise, but that's not much of a fund. So we had to focus on a couple small opportunities that were relatively early. And the whole model was that we would deploy that capital to invest in those opportunities or start them from scratch, as the case turned out to be, and apply ourselves as the entrepreneurial managers of that business, and then attempt to grow it and expand the business and get it funded, if you will. So that's what we did. We started two businesses, one of which didn't survive after the first couple of years, lasted about 2.5 years, and we had to shut that one down. The other one was just sold about 6 months ago, and that was the start of kind of what I'm doing right now. So I've been doing that in some form or fashion for about 13 years now, or 14 years since I left Big Auto, going from one of the biggest companies in the world to effectively cold start startups, where we would take that model and repeat it time and time again. So I've been involved with a number of small funds and companies that we've started as a result of that, that some of which haven't made it, some of which are doing very well and are with us today.
Wow. Sounds like there's so many different elements of your life and a lot of great reflection pieces. I think to really kind of start to work through some of that and learn from you and learn some of that great experience, I want to walk back to your MBA, really more of the time before you got your MBA. Obviously, there was probably some point in your time at GM where you realized the MBA was an option. And if you think back to yourself in that moment, can you maybe talk a little bit about why you chose to do it? I'm thinking along the lines of, there's probably a lot of engineers out there that are thinking, should I get my MBA? Is that something that's going to be of value to me? Can you maybe talk through how you decided to it, and then also your reflections on getting it? I mean, obviously you went down that route, but I'm curious as to your thoughts on that.
Absolutely. Yeah, I get asked that question quite a bit. So first of all, my personal decision to go get the MBA was really motivated by my interest in exploring other career paths. So again, early on, I personally assumed or planned not to stay in product development engineering for my career. I intended to pivot somewhere else. I ended up staying there longer than I did because of the way things progressed for me at General Motors. But my decision to go back to business school was really to leverage it as a learning experience and a career transition point, an opportunity to get into something new. And in fact, I think that's fairly common. I would say, obviously, you could look up the numbers, and I don't know what it is today versus when I went, but I would say a full third, if not in some cases even more, of the MBA class is comprised of engineers or engineering-like scientist-type folks. So it's a fairly common, in fact, it's probably the most significant demographic, or at least second maybe to folks that have accounting or other types of backgrounds. So it is not uncommon and is very well regarded in business school because of the analytical mindset. So for me personally, that was 100% my motivation. And when I got to the end of my business school tenure, I had, at that point, that's when you want to make it. If you do go to business school, before I answer the second half of your question, that is definitely what you want to do. You want to plan on, when I get to the end of this, if I'm going to business school with an intent to make a career transition, you want to take advantage of your graduation and the recruiting and, you know, that milestone, if you will, to make that happen. And I did not opt to do that because, again, due to the way things worked out where I was at General Motors at the time, at that point in my discernment, I was happy to ride that management development track at General Motors, and that's what I chose to do. But you definitely want to take advantage of that at the end of business school. I will say, in terms of who should you go to business school or not, and that's a question, again, that I get asked quite often, I would say that if you want to make a career change and you're committed to doing so, like I just outlined, you should definitely consider it and do it and commit to it and commit to making that change. If you are going to business school because your company is sending you because they want to invest in you and they see potential in you, obviously you would take that opportunity. I think that goes without saying if you have any interest in going to business school. If you are in an existing job with an existing company and you're going to business school thinking it's going to change your trajectory or your career prospects within that company, I would counsel otherwise, unless you have data that suggests otherwise. because I saw that quite often. In fact, the number of people followed my lead in my network at General Motors and also went to business school. And I don't think General Motors cared one bit that they went to business school. It certainly didn't affect their career trajectory, at least not in a time frame that they would consider to be significant. So I would say approach it cautiously if you're doing it, thinking it's going to get you ahead within your, you know, your current assignment or your current company, unless, of course, you've had that conversation with management and the company indicates that they feel differently. It's expensive, you know, and I think it does make a big difference where you go. If you go to, they told me on my first day at Ross, you're not going to learn anything here that you can't learn at any other school, any other college, or from a textbook for that matter. But look to your left, look to your right, shake those people's hands, because that's what you're going to get here. You're going to, the people you meet are going to be the value of this experience. And that was very true for me. In fact, one of the people I turned to my left and shook hands with today has been both a personal and a professional friend of mine since that time. It's been a very valuable relationship. So
I think that's a really interesting observation about your last one there, about the people you meet being maybe more important than the content of the education. And then your point before that about how if you're doing this to move ahead, that might not necessarily be the case within your company. I think there's a lot of people who, when they consider being a manager, think, well, if I get an MBA, that might help put me on that managerial track, which obviously you're saying may not be the case. Maybe in the majority of the time, depending on the company, may not be the case.
Yeah, you don't want to paint with a broad brush, but that was certainly my experience at General Motors. Let's put it that way.
Yeah, and I think that's a good observation in that people need to think about it, or as you said, have that conversation with their boss or someone within the company to say, hey, is this going to benefit? But when thinking about at least the education that you did get through that, aside from the networking that you mentioned, what were some of the other benefits, maybe immediately in maybe how you approached your work, and then maybe long term things that were a little less tangible in terms of how you viewed situations, whether in business or in life, or any other takeaways that you got from your MBA that you still carry with you today?
That could be a thesis, I guess, to some degree in and of itself, because what I learned in business school has been fundamental and invaluable to my experience on the business side. And I'd also say the same for my engineering experience, which is a little unique for my, perhaps some of my experiences are a little unique in that regard, because my business experiences have tended to be fairly technically focused. You know, I'm not doing general business management, for example, or consumer products management or marketing or stuff like that. It tends to be analytical finance oriented and heavy engineering type and technology development company stuff, so, or business stuff. So there's definitely a fusion between the two. But I would say my business school experience translated, I would say, substantially less into my day-to-day activity at General Motors, as opposed to my technical experience at General Motors feeding back into my business experience. And what I mean by that is my analytical training and system modeling and experience that I got in those areas was very valuable for me in analytical finance. So building in financial models, for example, complex financial models, once you understood from your business school training how the financial systems works, and I'm not talking the stock market necessarily, I'm just talking banking, accounting, how accounting works, you know, how you do financial accounting and you know, how different finance mechanisms work. Once you understood that, which is within the grasp, I think, of any engineer, because it's fairly mathematical, my engineering training was actually more valuable on the finance side, because it allowed me to really conceptualize things as it related to financial modeling, for example. On the, let's say, day-to-day operations at General Motors side, the part of the business school training that probably was most relevant was the strategic thinking that you got out of business school. Not so much strategic thinking insofar as you know, anybody can think strategically. You don't have to have a degree to do that. But the framework that they would teach you in business school about how to analyze a situation or an opportunity and think about it strategically and put it into a framework that you could organize your thoughts around, and more importantly, communicate your thoughts about something in a strategic context. That was, I would say, a valuable experience from business school that was relevant to my experience at General Motors.
Kevin, I agree. So I have my MBA actually as well. I got it actually immediately after my master's in engineering. And related to your point is it allowed me to help understand the world around me a lot better so that I could fit in it a lot better in a couple different ways. One, in a communication way, meaning I had the language, I had the words to help communicate to people around me that I understood the situation, but also that I could look and see why there was moves happening. I mean, analogy for GM would maybe be like, if you're an engineer there and you see, well, they're discontinuing this model or they're not doing this, and you don't, you go, well, why are they doing that? Why are they making these business decisions? Why are they handling the situation in this way? I think the business school for me allowed me to help kind of contextualize, or at least put frameworks around why decisions like that are happening.
I couldn't agree more. That's absolutely aligned with my experience. And also, I'll expand upon that. It's the language piece is an excellent point that you made there, because when you would hear, you know, business people talk, if you will, and I'm not talking just, you know, routine business talk. I'm talking, you know, acquisition stuff you might hear in the news from time to time, kind of understanding the finance piece of it and what those things mean, how to look at a P&L and understand what it tells you, for example. That's stuff that you don't learn in, or a balance sheet for that matter. That's stuff, obviously, we don't train in engineering school, but to be conversant in the world of business, you have to at least be conversant and understand those things. So it definitely is important in that regard.
Yeah, I felt like in some ways it was difficult for me while I was in my MBA, because when I was taking classes, I felt like they were training me to be a CEO. And what I hated about that is like statistically, I wasn't going to become a CEO. But there is great value in knowing what a CEO has to know and do. And you can be a good team member and a good support to the people at the top by knowing what their life is like and what things that they have to consider and what they're trying to analyze. Like what if, you know, if they're looking at the P&L, like what things are important to them, so that you can help as a team member of that team help grow it without having to ask a bunch of questions. I think there's great value in that too. That's not necessarily super direct. I mean, you know, to your question, Brennan, I guess going way back, like what are some of the other intangibles? There's some interesting things like that that were intangible to me. That's like, I was just a better team member in some ways. So Kevin, I think, you know, I imagine yourself there, you know, you got your MBA, you're thinking about maybe this career move. Yeah, I think you said right after your MBA that you were going to stay in the management track and kind of keep going. But at some point you started thinking about a big career move. And I think there's people listening probably now that are wondering if they should make a career move and wondering how that works. I'm curious if maybe you can tell us a little bit more about that and maybe what advice you'd have to the people who are thinking about big career moves.
Sure. Yeah. For me, it's easy for me. Obviously, it's so situation dependent for everybody else. But for me, it was driven 100% by just personal. I didn't want to look back. Like I mentioned earlier, I didn't want to look back when I was 50 and look in the mirror and see what I knew what I was going to see. Not that there's anything wrong with that. You're going to be very well compensated. You're going to have some great experiences, and you know, you're going to have success in every way that most people think of it from a career perspective. Had the path played out for me, you know, that I was on, obviously it may not have, but the path that I was on was certainly leading there. But that was not what I wanted to look back at 50 when I was 50 years old and say, I made it to where I wanted to be, because that's not where I wanted to be. And that was 100% personal preference. It was something in me that wanted to be an entrepreneur. I wanted to be a builder. I wanted to try to make something happen and build a company or build something from, from scratch and try to make something out of it. it was more of a personal thing. So that's what motivated me at the end of the day. It was not so much a career change. It was just, in fact, it was a very irresponsible career change, if you will. I remember the exit, the HR interviewer at General Motors, as I was walking out, you know, your exit interview, if you will, you hand over your keys and everything. And the woman asked me, are you really sure you know what you're doing? You know, nobody, I have never had anybody do this before. Somebody in your position. She said that to me straight up. I've never had somebody in your position at this point in your career straight up and walk out the door voluntarily. Are you sure you know what you're doing? And I wasn't, you know. So to me, I just didn't want to have any regrets. And that's, I think, pretty unique, because I wouldn't necessarily counsel that to anybody, although I know other people have found themselves in the same situation and have done similar things. So I guess it's not that unusual. So back to somebody who's thinking about a career change, I will say this, have a plan. I did not have a plan because I was jumping into something very unknown and highly volatile, which I was willing to do because it was, to me, a risk return calculation. But if you unless you're making that same calculation, you gotta have a plan. Where do you want to go and why? And take some steps to get yourself in a position for those, you know, for that next move, and then make the move where you have a place to land. Unless, of course, you're willing to throw caution to the wind and just pick up the tent and move to places and move to Silicon Valley and roll the dice, for example. You know, I'm just speaking in hyperbole, of course, but you could certainly do that. But for most people, I think it's wise to have a plan. And that's where, I guess, business school, if I'm not answering your question here, but if that's where business school is a great catalyst, back to the business school topic, because if you have a plan, the time in business school gives you an opportunity to lay the groundwork for that plan. And then the completion of business school is your catalyst to execute that plan.
You said that even though as you know, you were getting walked out there and asked, you really want to do this? Yes, even though if you don't necessarily have a big plan, obviously you had some idea about what you wanted to do. So for someone who may be thinking about this, and now that you've gone through it and reflecting back on it, what are some of those things that you either wished you had thought about more or would advise someone to consider when they're making a big change like this, whether that's leaving something for the unknown, going to start your own business or entrepreneurship? What are some of those things that you would suggest someone think about?
I'll approach that answer from the context of entrepreneurship, because it to be distinguished from somebody leaving job X to go to job Y, or even doing the same thing, or job X to job Y doing an entirely different thing. I think that's a different, that's a little bit different. I'm going to answer your question from the context of jumping in to be an entrepreneur, meaning, you know, you're going to either start a business or you're going to join up with something that's, get involved with something that's highly volatile and very risky and entrepreneurial. My advice to somebody who's looking to do the latter, something entrepreneurial or start a business, those types of things, is first of all, one, understand what your tolerance for risk is, or have a real good feel for what your tolerance for risk is and what's your line in the sand. You know, I am willing to ride this until I get to point X. And at point X, I have to pull the plan B, you know, whatever the plan is. So then the follow on to that is, what's my plan B? You know, so if I reach point X objectively, I at that point have to start pivoting to do something different, execute another strategy, which might be go find another job, go back to go call the same people I used to work for and see if I can get my old job back, or go to school and try to do something and then pivot from there. It could take many forms, But the advice is have a line in the sand that you draw, kind of a milestone. If I don't get to this point, I have to pivot and execute plan B, and make sure that the people that are important to you, your family, if that's relevant, that would be the most important one, obviously, they're on board with that plan. So everybody's going into it eyes wide open. And, it's not just you going it alone, so to speak.
I think that's really important, Kevin. I think to look at the idea of making a move and having a plan, I think tying it also back to the MBA, the business degree, is helping you framework that, look at, okay, well, what is risk? What are my opportunity costs of not having my engineering salary? What are these other important things that I need to evaluate in this decision, but also so that you know financially what you're getting into? I think finances are a big part of the decision, but it's also more than that. And I guess it's tying for those listening that are interested in maybe this career move, like Kevin's talking about, to an entrepreneurial jump, like having a business background to some extent will be really helpful in that jump, as opposed to the jumps that you weren't talking about, Kevin, right? Jumping from company X to company Y, doing the same thing or a different thing. Like that, an MBA is not going to be as valuable there as trying to jump into an entrepreneurial. Even if you're jumping into a startup company that has a few members, your ability to understand, they raised $10 million, but they only have $100,000 in cash. Like there's a cash account. Like how much cash do they have? And there's how much money are they, did they raise and things like that. But you got to be able to think through some of these things. And I think what you're describing there is another great indication of, the value of having at least the business frameworks behind you.
I agree completely. You could do it without it. I mean, there's a lot of, I don't want to, just to clarify that, I wouldn't want to make anybody that's listening to this think that to go out and be an entrepreneur, you have to have a business background first. So go get an MBA and then try to be an entrepreneur. That is definitely not the case. Although it certainly helps, and everything you said is absolutely true. It's not a prerequisite, because there are people out there that it's all about team. And if you get in the entrepreneurial mode, if you will, you can generally get yourself, surround yourself with people, or get people to work, collaborate with you, who can bring some of those additional skill sets and insights if you lack them. So it's not a requirement, but I certainly, given the choice, you would want to have it if you could do so.
Sure. So I guess going back to your younger self, a couple months into the new job, or even many months, a year or two, What did you get wrong? What did you assume it was going to be like this, but it was different? Like what failure in your expectations was there?
I would say no failure in expectations. I got what I expected. Other than obviously you would have hoped for different. I mean, of course, everybody has the dream of starting a company and it being the next Google, for example. I mean, I knew that wasn't going to be the case, and certainly there was no preconceptions that was going to happen, but obviously you got to have that dream and that drive and that vision, but also have realistic expectations so you're not disappointed when that doesn't happen. So I wasn't really, I would say, disappointed or anything with how things started out, because we started, for example, in this, going back to the first year or two, let's say, into this new career path, we started two companies. So we raised about, like I said, $2 million or so, started two companies with that from scratch. So you got to be a founder of two companies from scratch. And then each of those companies would then go out and raise additional money to try to further its own interests, so kind of you had two companies with common ownership, if you will, that were then trying to do their own thing because they weren't totally unrelated. And, for me, that was my dream, right? That's what I wanted. That's exactly what I wanted to do. So even though it was grueling and it was fraught with disappointments and, small wins and small losses every given day, to me, that's actually what got me up in the morning and kept me motivated and excited, because I was I had the opportunity to make everything happen, and I wasn't doing it myself, obviously, but but you know, you had people helping you. You were part of a team that was trying to do this, but you knew every day that you were the part of building something that was either going to succeed or not succeed, largely based on your effort, or in significant part to your effort. And that's exactly what I wanted to do. So I loved it. You know, I loved every bit of that, even though I knew deep down, in fact, almost from the start, that one of the companies was not going to make it. I just knew that it was not, not something that is probably a good idea to execute on. But the guy that I had joined up with, who was obviously the senior operator and the one with the most experience, he was fully committed to it. So I was fully committed to it as well, because I knew that if we weren't working together, nothing was going to happen, for example. So that was, just learning how to gauge to try to answer your question here. I learned so much from that experience. I don't think I had any regrets about even though things didn't all go well, I didn't have any regrets from any of it, because even the bad stuff became things that you were able to play forward and apply to the next opportunity. And that's just how things have continued for me since then.
Yeah, you've touched on a few things there that are definitely very different than what life is like working for a big company. So can you contrast maybe a little more than you already have what it's like when you're working at a startup or a company you're founding versus like big business in terms of culture or how they function, or just even what to expect? Because I know that those are two, going from a company of 100,000 plus people to a company of one or two or 10 is completely different.
Oh yeah, absolutely. First of all, I can tell you that culture can be terrible in a small company as it can in a big company. So this is, again, is not an absolute based on bigger versus small. But if you're in a small company environment, particularly an entrepreneurial environment, and certainly one of the environments that I've been in, either the ones I've built from scratch or have had the opportunity to be part of, there is just a tremendous night and day difference from the big company experience. And it primarily comes down to the feeling that you are, if it's done right, the feeling that you are every day making an impact that is material to the prospects of the company. You know, at General Motors, for example, even though I had the ability to make substantially more impact than a good number of the people there by virtue of the positions that I was in, you still knew that you were a small cog in a huge machine that already had been built. As a small company person and certainly a startup person, it's your job to build the machine. And that's what I tell people all the time. I'm a machine builder. Metaphorically, I'm a machine builder. I'm not happy in a machine that's been built. My job is to build the machine and make that machine run. And then other people can come run that machine and I'll go build the next machine. And if you want to build that machine with me, you're in the right place. If you expect, and this is when I would interview people for jobs in my companies, I would say, if you're expecting to come to work every day and know exactly what you have to do and have a defined job and two hands, 8 hours, punch the clock and leave, be a cog in the machine, if you will, you're not in the right place. We're not going to get along well, and this is not going to, you're not going to be happy here, or you will not be long for this assignment. But if you want to come to work every day and help build that machine and figure things out and take every opportunity that's presented to you and make things happen, then you're in the right place. And for the most part, those are the types of to me, that was when I would be, for example, looking to get people to join, to hiring people, recruiting people to join in whatever capacity. That was the number one thing I looked for. Were they that type of person, could operate in an unstructured environment and make things happen with minimal direction and help me build that machine? And those are the people that you wanted with you. So if you're one of those types of people, there's opportunities for you to do that. But that having been said, there's a lot to be said for lifestyle and stress, and just maybe some people are wired for the opposite. And, you know, if you just want to come to work every day, have a nice, steady, stable job, predictable, and, you know, obviously that has work-life balance implications and other things with it. There's nothing wrong with those things, but you're less likely to find that in the, in a highly entrepreneurial environment than you are in a, let's say a large company environment with an established machine.
Is it really unstable, Kevin? I mean, one thing I think a lot of people assume looking at the idea of moving into an entrepreneurial environment is that it will be unstable. Most people probably think financially, but stress level and two, I guess, in your experience, was it that for you? I mean, was it really actually financially unstable for you while you were starting these companies? Or, I mean, or you don't have to talk about that if you don't want to, but also like, was even just the stress levels, is that expectation really true?
Oh yeah, for sure. I mean, sir, there's different elements to that. The stability for depends where you're at. Like for example, if you were working, I'm going to talk solely from the context of my companies that I've been involved with or actually run. If you were working in one of my companies, you never saw financial uncertainty. I mean, we've never missed a payroll. We paid people pretty well. We paid them, you know, market comparable. To me, that's important. You know, I never wanted to. That's just how I roll. Even when times were tight, we still always made payroll, and you never saw any financial uncertainty. Now, you might not have known that didn't apply to me necessarily. I might not be getting paid, you know, for extended periods of time, but that was because my role in that particular enterprise, but the people who were involved in that same enterprise with me in a highly entrepreneurial environment, they never saw that financial instability. Now, they might not have known that we just made payroll by, you know, 90 minutes or whatever before defaulting on, you know, a bank draw or something along those lines. They didn't know that, but nevertheless, they never saw any uncertainty, if you will. But I would say in general, the volatility is probably less on the financial side. Even though that does happen, obviously you have spectacular crashes and things can, the rug can get pulled out of you at any time. You never know. But the uncertainty can often be more on the personnel side. And what I mean by that is in a small company, there's smaller company, especially a startup company, there's just no room to hide anybody, if you will, or if you don't have the right person in the right seat on the bus, you don't have a lot of time to find the right seat for that person on the bus. A big company can do that. They can move you around, find a better job for you, help develop you, put you on a, you know, performance management program, whatever the case may be. And I'm not talking low performers here either. I'm just talking people that may not be the right fit for the right job. I could have the best engineer in the world on a project or in a company, but if it's an engineer that doesn't have it's not the best person to do a very specific task that needs to be done at that time, you might have to let that engineer go, for example. And it has nothing to do with their performance. It's just the fact that they're not in the right seat on the bus. That's more the volatility you'll get, I think, in a small company environment than you'll see in a large company environment.
Yeah, I think... referencing a lot of Jim Collins' thoughts there, the idea of first who, then what. This, for those not listening, Jim Collins, he's a writer, really excellent writer, but talks to this idea of getting the right people on the bus and how it can be so much that. And I can only imagine in that startup, in that small company world, like that is, it becomes even so much more critical to do that. And so maybe we can transition to this idea a little bit, or this next kind of topic, but this idea of, there's probably a lot of people listening who are engineers who are maybe thinking about starting a company, maybe side business, maybe actually hopefully to turn it someday into a full business. And I think it's hard to know how and when to do that. And we've talked a little bit about making big career moves and things like that, but I guess maybe can you talk a little bit to just that broad idea of the person sitting in the chair listening that's like, well, I would like to start a business. I'm an engineer. I have technical knowledge. I think I might have a widget or an idea. Maybe what would be your advice to that person sitting in that chair?
Oh, certainly. Yeah. And I see that a lot because I interact with a lot of those people. They ask me exactly that question. And I always try to help them as much as I can, as well as I understand personally how challenging that is. First of all, I'll say there is an element of pick the right horse, I guess, for lack of a better metaphor. And that is your, whatever you're going to build a business on or whatever you're interested in doing, you want to develop a technology, you want to development of technology or building a product and building a business are kind of three different things, but they all have the same entrepreneurial DNA, if you will, but considerably different trajectories as it relates to, you know, how much time it takes, how much money it takes, so on and so forth. But let's just lump them all into the same bucket for a moment. The first thing to discern is my idea or what it is I want to do, first of all, something that I'm really, really passionate about. Am I willing to every day get up and do what it takes to make this happen, you know, for 12, 14, 16 hours, whatever it is, right? Is it really, really my passion that I want to make it happen? That's certainly important. You got to have passion about it. You got to be excited because that's what's going to get you over the hard times that you are no doubt going to have. So you have to answer that for yourself. But then the next thing is, if you pardon the metaphor, does the dog hunt? Is what I'm endeavoring to do worthwhile? And it may be worthwhile to me, and it might be worthwhile to somebody, but it is worthwhile to enough people or at a large enough scale to make it relevant, in which case, and that's, we call that customer discovery, or there's other ways to look at that, but is it relevant? And that the only way you can get that feedback is to start talking to other people and say, hey, I'm thinking of doing this. You know, what do you think? Or would it be, you know, give me feedback on my idea. Would it be relevant? You can ask, and some of that you can do by asking people what they think. Some of it is just hard research. You know, is there an unmet market need out there that I think I can fill? And if I can identify and quantify that unmet market need and come up with something obviously that addresses that market need, you can get an idea objectively as terms of whether or not your idea has merit. And then you can start asking people for their feedback on top of that. So that's certainly number two. So passion, number two is having something that has, does the dog hunt? Is whatever I want to do relevant enough at scale, or can I achieve whatever scale is relevant to make it meaningful and worthwhile to me economically, or it may not even be economic. It might be some other metric that you care about. If it's, say, a social mission or something like that, you can apply the same thought process. Then I would say number three is your timeline and scale, I guess, is timeline/scale. And that is, how long is it going to take me to make this happen? Is it, you know, if I've got an idea for cold fusion, for example, you know, it may be a great idea and certainly meets an unmet market need, but it's going to take me a million years and a bajillion dollars to figure it out if it's even within the realm of, you know, physics, right, to make it happen. So therefore, it's, you know, you got to discern it on that axis as well. Is this something that can be pulled off on a timeline and at a resource scale that is realistic for me to access? And that's a little bit more of a, there's an objective element to that, but also a subjective element, because some things can start small, obviously, and then snowball from there. So you know, you can achieve a lot of scale very fast if you really hit on something good. But if without getting too wordy on it, I think you kind of get the idea that if you have an idea that's extremely complex, going to take a ton of R&D and, you know, very sophisticated labs and so on and so forth, the amount of scale and the time required to get to a meaningful milestone that is a value creation inflection point is going to be very difficult to achieve. And therefore, unless you've got a rich uncle who's got that type of capital resource, probably not a good idea to bet your 401k on that.
Sure. Yeah, and I think that's definitely an important part. You know, being especially if you're the engineer sitting at that desk and you're thinking about doing this, you're the one who would probably know the most about that technology, or hopefully does, in being able to forecast how long it could get to a point where then the business side comes in where it reaches a point of value. And I think related to that, I'm just curious: are these endeavors aren't forever? I think that's the interesting part about entrepreneurship is, you know, you might be. It seems to me that a lot of companies try to build to get bought, and I don't think there's anything wrong with that. I mean, it's like a market's way of R&D, which is great. But for people that are wondering about this entrepreneur step, can that be a 5-10 year thing? Like, I mean, to failure too, but also success. Like, is if someone's sitting there saying, you know, I want to try that entrepreneurship thing, but you know, maybe towards the end of my career, or I only think I could give it 5 to 15 years, or if you go down that entrepreneurship path, do you need to be in it for longer than that? Does that question make sense?
It makes total sense. Back to your previous question in terms of discerning whether you're willing to step off into this great unknown. Your timing question there is, assume that it is a 5 to 10 year deal, and assume that it is going to take 2 years to even get off the flight deck, so to speak, meaning you're going to spend, unless you've got something that's, let's say, unique, most things are at least a 2-year incubation period. And so it's going to take you 2 years just to learn, to develop the relationships, to develop the product, assuming there's a product, obviously. There's always a product of some type. Even if it's a service, it's still a product. If you have something, to get a first customer, get people interested in it, all the things you need to do, build a team, you know, there's a whole host of things. It's going to take you 2 years just to get to the point where it looks interesting. And then after that, you might get your first, get your first real investor at that point. And now you're just at the start of the road, right? And now it's going to take you another 3 years or 4 years after that to really turn it into something that is significant, either as a standalone business or as a product or technology that another company is willing to buy. And I think that's in a best case scenario, you know, so expect 2 years of wandering in the desert and, you know, having a really hard time. And then you gotta be willing to commit to that. And then after that, it's going to be at least another couple of years. So now you're looking at 5 years, and you said 5 to 10. I think that's right on. No less than 5 years before you have something significant. I mean, to give you a benchmark, and again, the stuff I do is kind of I think this bears out across all the companies I've seen, and I've been involved with lots of companies directly, but indirectly with dozens or even, you know, even more than dozens of startup companies. And they're all, the ones that haven't already folded tent are all 7, 8, 9, 10 years old and are still, you know, still in those relatively small stages of growth, if you will. So it can be a long haul.
Let's say that you've started on this journey and you're a few years in, but you're not kind of hitting some of those milestones and getting some of those victories, and you're not sure what to do. When do you know when to call it quits, when to say, hey, this venture maybe doesn't have a future or hasn't turned out like we hoped?
Yeah, the first sign is kind of as we talked about, or I might have mentioned earlier, you know, having those things predefined so that you know. And of course, you can start, you don't know what you don't know at the beginning of anything. So you can set up some milestones and you may have to change them as you go, but try to adhere to the spirit of those milestones. So you might say, hey, I'm going to give myself 18 months to establish, you know, this. And if you get to 18 months and you haven't achieved the spirit of that, that might be the, you know, kind of the trigger for you to the pivot to something different. But objectively, what are some of the things that you need to, which I think is more at what you're asking, what are the some of the things you need to do that are, let's say, common and objective across all opportunities? I think the first thing is you got to find whatever it is you're looking to do. You have to find establish that there is a significant unmet need, or that you have a customer, you know, and ideally you have a customer, you know, somebody who's saying, hey, I'm willing to buy this if you can deliver it. Or, and so that obviously the biggest validation point is you have something to deliver and they are buying it. Even if it's, you know, kind of on a speculative basis, you know, that can take many forms, but you get customer validation, as we call it, from somebody. That's a sign that you got something at least, right? But some things take more than, you know, 18 months or 2 years to get to the point where you can have a customer. So at that point, you have to have technical milestones that say, look, if I can achieve this level of validation or this level of development and demonstrate X, then I know that objectively this warrants me to continue, because if I can get to X, people have told me that will be significant. And so you if you can't get to X, you have to ask yourself, am I ever going to get to X, whatever X might be? And how long am I willing to make the sacrifices and put the effort into getting there, you know, not knowing if it can be achieved? And that becomes a little bit of a gut call on your part. Sometimes a call is made for you. If it takes money to get there, you don't have the money and an investor pulls the plug, obviously then the decision has been made for you. And that happens all the time. But if you're doing it on your own, let's say as a side hustle, and you know, you're working your butt off trying to make something happen on the side, but you know, you can't get to this point where, I'm going to use an example, you know, I'm going to say I need to have a customer I'm going to build a software application that does something. I'm going to do that software application 100% on the side. So I don't need to raise a bunch of money or I don't need hardware. I don't need anything. It's 100% myself writing computer code to build this application, but I'm going to sacrifice all my spare time for 2 years to make that happen. And you get to the end of that period of time and you don't have anybody that is willing to use that application and pay you for it, which I would suggest would be a milestone. You know, there you got to ask yourself, why am I doing this?
Yeah, Kevin, I love the idea of speaking to making it objective. And I think it's hard because, especially in the passion project realm where it's a lot of emotions. I think maybe luckily as engineers, when we're not known for our emotional side, maybe we're well suited for startups and because of that, because we're not as emotional people in general. But you got to watch yourself, I would imagine, on the emotions. And you kind of check that with objective data. You know, people even say you're going to go buy a car. Well, figure out your budget and then go to the dealership. And, you know, so that way when they say, well, if you get the next trim level up, it's only this much more, you can be like, no, my budget says X and that's over X. So no. And I think that turns it objective. And I think that's important and sounds like important in this realm too. In definitely in the more intangible realms, like your you know, your coding example, it's that can get extremely emotional, but you have to weigh that opportunity cost, right? That 2 years of giving up all your free time could have been what? Could have been spending more time with family. Could have been going on trips. There are costs of pursuing a path in that you're not pursuing other paths. And that's a decision that you should make consciously.
Absolutely. And that's actually might want to be the most important points of anybody that's looking to undertake something of this nature because I see a lot of these. I see and generally engineers, I'll say, because they have the technical skills and the ability to make things, generally speaking. So it's not always just engineers, but I see a lot of engineers they want to be entrepreneurs. They got the day job and they're working on stuff on the side, but they might even appreciate it, but they're not willing to make the sacrifices. What they don't know how how much they really need to commit to make it happen. And if you're doing it half in, you are highly unlikely ever to get there. You can go half in until the point at which you're willing to go all in, but you can't keep going half in forever and expect something to make it obvious, you know, that you should go all in, because that's only going to be driven by you. You know, it's kind of a you going all in and making something happen that wasn't going to happen otherwise is what's going to make the difference. It's not going to happen by itself, just by you hanging around and continuing to work on something, you know, or having some great idea that you work on an hour a week or something like that, that someday is going to make you rich or, you know, allow you to start your own company or whatever it is. I just don't think that happens. You know, you've got to at some point say, I am going to make this happen. And you can't do that with a quarter of your time or something like that. I just don't think it works. It takes too much energy to overcome the inherent resistance to, you know, to making something like that happen.
Yeah, that's a really good point, that not everything is necessarily going to work out, and you really have to be dedicated to it. And so we're coming up on time, but I got one last question for you, which I think kind of ties a lot of this together, is that you've mentioned in our conversation so far towards the beginning, like you knew that you didn't necessarily want to be at GM for forever, that you had other goals in life and things you wanted to do. And a lot of that sounds like you really took time to reflect on where you were at in life, where you wanted to go, what was important. Can you maybe just comment a little bit here and we close out about the importance of taking time to reflect and really looking inside about your goals and the wants and desires for your life and how you might go about kind of trying to think through that in a way that can be helpful?
Yeah, certainly. I'm blessed to be surrounded by a group of friends from all different stages of my life, but a good number of them from my engineering school experience, right? College friends, if you will, and folks that weren't college friends, but are still engineers from other colleges, if you will, in engineering jobs. And the thing that I've seen happen too many times, which again is kind of why I didn't want to be that one of those, is people get into, they get stuck in the routine. They have a golden handcuff kind of, you know, not great, not a very well paying job. I would say a great paying job as it relates to the, you know, the what most people are blessed with in this country and certainly in this world. But, you know, that there, nobody's buying Learjets or anything like that on an engineering salary, obviously. So they've got nice, comfortable jobs and, you know, good work-life balance in a lot of cases. And every day just becomes like the next. And they go, you know, there's no real catalyst or motivation for change unless it comes from within them. And they just stay doing the same thing and not really growing for years. And a decade goes by and it's not so bad. And then it becomes 2 decades, right? And now you're 20 years into your career or 35 or 25 years in your career. And, you know, you really haven't grown, haven't done anything different. And, you know, that still may be okay and still may work out for you great. And you still may be happy, but I see a lot of people that aren't, you know, they're frustrated now. They're bored. They're frustrated with where they're at. They don't like what they're doing and they can't get out of the rut. They can't because they are afraid to, or they don't want to, or man, in some cases, you know, as you get older, obviously it's even scarier because if there's a downsizing or you go through some type of reduction in force, you know, you find yourself, you know, looking for a new job, which you see happen to a lot of mid-career folks. And again, that's really scary. So I think that you have to be diligent about reflecting on that, starting at the early stages of your career and constantly challenging yourself to break that mold, because it's super, super easy to get stuck into that, on that track. And in fact, the companies love it because they love nothing more than having dedicated, loyal, skilled engineers, let's say, labor in general, but certainly skilled engineers, you know, who are willing to do the same thing and keep them out of trouble for as long as it's convenient until it's no longer convenient. And at that point, you're labor. And you know, thank you, but we don't need you anymore kind of thing. Nobody else is going to do that for you. So you have to commit to yourself early in your career or even late in your career to say, I don't want to be that person. I want to be somebody who's always constantly challenging myself. And even if I stay at the same place, it's not about moving jobs every 2 years or anything like that. I'm not suggesting that, but always continuing to ask yourself, am I really happy doing what I'm doing? And if I'm not, what change am I going to make to go at, you know, talk to your management about doing something different, go back to school, go start a business. I mean, who knows what it is? It doesn't have to be any particular thing, but don't just keep doing the same thing, because that's what leads so many people to being. And again, I feel like I'm saying the same thing over and over again, but that ultimately is what drove me to do what I did. Because when I looked at the people who had been doing the same things for in a big company as a product development engineer for 50 years, or not 50 years, but when they were 50, but you know, 30-year career, a lot of them were frustrated. You know, they didn't want to come to work every day. They were frustrated. They couldn't wait to retire. And that's not what I wanted to do.
Well, Kevin, with that, I guess I'd really just like to say thank you. Thank you for coming on and telling us your story. You know, you have such an awesome story. I think it's really fantastic. And I think what I'm really loving about it is just your ability to make the choices you want to make and not letting the system kind of say, hey, you know, here's your path. You know, really, and even in your hand saying, nope, like this, I'm going to do what I want to do. And, you know, there's goods and bads of that. And I appreciate you coming on and telling us about that today.
Oh, happy to be here. And, you know, hopefully it, help some other folks as well. I see a lot of, like I said, I see a lot of aspiring entrepreneurs. Most of them have engineering backgrounds, or a good number of them. I would say over half of them have engineering backgrounds, and they're all exactly, you know, thinking some of the, everything we talked about this evening here, they're thinking those same things all the time. So you're not the only one out there if that's what you're thinking.
Yeah. This was a great conversation, Kevin. We really, really appreciate you coming on. That was a really good conversation. I don't think that was all what I expected going into it, but Kevin really had a lot of cool experiences and a lot of cool insights into things beyond the normal engineering career track.
Yeah, I agree. Different than previous episodes, but I think in a very good way. I'm just, you know, providing some great different views of the engineering world and kind of what you can do and what you can make of it if that is what you want to do. Yeah, that really great to have him on.
Yeah, he's definitely had a unique journey. And I think kind of the question I asked there towards the end about reflecting and his answer to that, I think kind of it provided a lot of insight to me in ways I hadn't necessarily thought about, in that we're all on this path. We only have, you know, so long of a career or so many opportunities to do something. And we really have to make a conscious effort to understand if what we're doing is what we want to keep doing, or if we want to do something else and to do that and make it happen, whether that's going and getting an MBA for the purpose of starting a new business, whether that's moving within a company, starting your own company. There's lots of different paths people can take. And I think it's easy, like you said, to kind of float through it and come out 20 years later not happy with it. So taking time early on or even late just to start today thinking about, am I doing what I want to do, or do I need to make a change?
Yeah, I think that's great. I think it's hard to do, especially when life starts, you know, building up, you know, you start building the family, you start buying the house, you start getting settled. It can be scary and it can be hard. And so I think it emphasizes the importance of doing it as early as possible that way, just because, you know, it's harder. It is. It's just harder when life starts getting fuller. And so, you know, you want to be conscious of that and really think about it. I think one of the things for me, I guess related to the MBA, is just tying back the importance of the network, you know, or that meaning that can be one of the big things. You know, if you're thinking about getting your MBA and you know, you're trying to figure out what it is, what is the purpose, you know, as we've talked about before, like have a purpose for if you're going to get a graduate degree, including the MBA, like what is your purpose? Like that network can be an important part. And that's really what separates the big Ivy League or the big name schools versus the other ones. He even said it was great, the professors at Ross, that, you know, you what you're going to learn here, the content is the same at any other MBA course. It's the people around you in the network that are going to make the difference. And so that can help you when deciding what, where you should go for your MBA. If you, if the tool that you're trying to get is just the language and the frameworks and things, you can get that anywhere. So don't go spend a bunch of money. But if you want to have it be the network that you gain, then you need to try to get to the biggest name you can get to. And I think that's a good thing to think about when you're trying to think strategically about why you might want to get the MBA or why you're getting it.
Yeah, you have your MBA. I don't. That's actually something, like this feedback is something good to think about. Like, is it worth getting an MBA for the network? I don't know. We'll see. That's a decision I have to reflect on and think about. So who knows? But
yeah, another good episode, man. Well, appreciate your time, Brennan. Hope you have a good night, buddy.
Yeah, you too. Oh, before I forget, we should think about this. People out there listening, you're listening to this in April. We were talking about snow at the beginning of the episode. We're recording this in February. So if you think that there's like a bunch of snow somewhere in April, there could be, but there also might not be. So don't think we're too crazy.
Oh, there'll be snow up here still in April. I'm not too worried about that. We'll still have,
I guess I should say there definitely won't be snow here in April. So,
but yeah, other things, if you're listening, feedback, give us feedback. We'd love to hear people's thoughts. Did you like this different episode? Was that what you were interested in? Feel free to send us a note on the website or wherever. Let us know if you're liking what we're doing or if we could do things differently that would be better for you. Do you like how long we do it? Do you like the hour format? Would you like something shorter? What would be the most value to you? We'd love that feedback.
Definitely. And as you're going to hear me say at the end of the episode, if you got a cool story, you know someone who has a cool story, let us know. Like, we'd love to talk to them and get more viewpoints from people all over their careers doing all kinds of stuff.
Yeah, buddy. All right, everyone. Have a good night. Bye-bye.
Bye. Thanks for listening to this episode of Engineer Your Career with Troy Bauman and Brennan Timrak. For more information about the show, visit our website at eycpodcast.com. There you can find show notes for each episode and get in touch with Troy and I. If you or someone you know are an engineer with an interesting or even not so interesting career journey and would like to be on the show, go on the website, send us a short bio, and we may just invite you to come on and share your story. And finally, if you want to show your support, please rate, review, like, or subscribe to the show on your podcast player of choice.